Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Toby.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling meticulous. Because I feel like today's guest is a really meticulous, caring... There was actually another word I was thinking about, or a phrase anyway, which is kind of TLC, like tender loving care. Mm. And I feel like today's guest is someone that really takes care of the
nurturing.
Yes, nurturing is a good one. I should have said nurturing.
Should have done. Well, you've said it. You said it now.
Today, Russell, I'm feeling nurturing. Yeah, I just feel like today's guest is really takes care of the artists that she works with and collaborates with and promotes. But also the artist that we're going to be speaking about today is a very meticulous artist and really makes intense, detailed, beautiful, inspiring ceramic sculptures that, I don't know, they just have this intensity of feeling in them. And I always think about them as being very sort of fine, precise, you know, focused detail. Mm. And our guest today has already been on the podcast about a year or so ago, and it went down so well and we enjoyed it. It was literally one of the highlights of our show this far that we thought today it would be really great on the occasion of a show that's opening in New York of this artist's work to just focus in meticulously on one artist instead of all of her roster and just focus on this one artist. So we would like to welcome again to Talk Art, Jennifer Gilbert.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome back, Jen.
Hi, welcome back.
Pleased to be back.
Well, yeah, amazing. Well, first off, what has the experience been like being a guest on Talk Art?
And amazing.
Yeah? Why? In what way?
Well, what an incredible experience. I mean, the feedback that I received after it went live, and even still to this day, has just been so heartwarming and so wonderful. From artists, from gallerists around the world, from people just, you know, the fact that people have taken time out of their day to want to send me a message to say how much they enjoyed hearing about it and, you know, how wonderful it is that there's people in this country working with, you know, disabled or self-taught artists. And then the fact that, you know, gallerists that I've never even spoken to before contacted me and were just like, the work you're doing is amazing. Let's do something together. Let's have a conversation. Let's have a chat. I mean, it was just incredible. What a wonderful opportunity to share what I do. So thank you.
Oh my God, you're so welcome. We're so proud. You're definitely one of the highlights that we've had. And like, it felt like a breakthrough episode for us and for the genesis of Talk Art, but also for, you know, it felt exciting to kind of be a conduit for people to discover more about you and the artists that you work with. So,
Then the fact that you've had artists like Lucy Jones afterwards, that's got cerebral palsy, it was such a highlight to listen to someone like that and to hear her story and to talk about, you know, to hear her talking about her art was, you know, a joy to listen to, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And actually our Talk Art book even sort of progressed in a different direction, because there's a chapter in there which is dedicated to a lot of the artists that you work with, and I think we name check you in there as well. But like that was something I think was added to the book, you know, since we did your interview, which was really, really great. And I feel like that's the other thing I love about you, and I'll quickly just be a fanboy for a second, but I really love the idea that you're such a great educator. Like, I just think you really do educate people in a really accessible way, and I think it's really important to highlight, you know, the work of what some people call outsider art, but really it's self-taught art, and I don't know, it's just a wonderful kind of world. And so today we are going to be speaking about one of your artists who's based in Japan called Shinichi Sawada. There's an exhibition at the moment about to open in New York with Venus Over Manhattan. And we'd like to say a big hi to Adam and my friend Anna Fernie as well. I love Anna. She's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Who you've been collaborating with there. Mm-hmm. And so this is in the Upper East Side space. Is that right?
They're on, I think they're on 65th Street. I think they moved last year, didn't they? Yeah, so
okay.
They're in a different space now, but it's cool. It's still a beautiful space, nonetheless.
Yeah, amazing. Well, it's incredibly exciting because this is an artist who's self-taught, as we said. He's 38, he's based in Japan, and he was diagnosed at 18 with autism, and he's non-verbal. And for you, you've been championing his work and working alongside him and the studio that he works at for many years. And this is his first solo exhibition in the States. So for you, this is an incredibly exciting time. It opens February 20th, as we said, at Venus Over Manhattan. So what does that feel like to be at this stage in this artist's career?
I mean, it's incredible for an artist like Sawada to have this opportunity to have a solo show in New York of all places and at such a beautiful gallery space that's had some very well-respected artists shown there. And I think what's important to highlight is for most artists living in Japan and for lots of the studios there, they see it as a real career highlight. Their goal in life is to have a show in America. And wow. For them, that means they've made it. Yeah. So his studio staff are like absolutely ecstatic. He's got this incredible opportunity ahead of him.
Isn't
to have
cool?
this solo show. It's, yeah. I mean, it's so exciting. It's yeah.
So, well, let's talk about the studio then for people listening that don't understand yeah. the process. So they have these studios set up in Japan, which I don't, is this unique to Japanese culture? That there is a support for that, or are we seeing them all around the world, but we might be unaware of them?
Yeah, they're definitely all over the world. There's plenty across the UK, plenty across America. You know, every country will have these studios in some form, some shape or form. But in Japan, they're slightly different setup often because the studio that he goes to has lots of the Japanese. Disabled artists have paid work that they do if they're able to do paid work, and they do that within the studio space, and then the other half of the day they'd spend on the creative activities. So within his studio space there's a few different things that can happen. So he works in the bakery there making bread in the mornings, the 3 days a week that he goes there. And in the afternoon other people there often go out into the local community to sell the things they've been making. Or the other side, which Sawada started when he first went there, was like packaging things into boxes. So it's almost like a construction line. So a company pays the studio a certain amount of money, and then the disabled artists then do this work and package things into these boxes for this company and then pass them across, and the next lot comes in. So that's very different to the other models around the world, and lots of other models don't have that kind of half work, half creative thing in that respect. So it's quite different, and it's quite unique in Japan.
How did he get to that studio? I just want to clarify, when it comes to names, like my name is Russell Tovey here, and Russell's first, but in Japanese culture, you're reading backwards. So you are saying Sawada. Is Sawada his first name, but we see it written down as...
No, his name is, I mean, over there, when I went to visit him, they called him Shinichi.
Shinichi, yeah.
Shinichi Sawada. But for everyone else, he's just known as Sawada. So, I mean, when I work with people in Japan, I often just call them by their last name.
But how did he get to this studio then? So he's 38
yeah,
now. When
so
did he
start? Yeah, so he's 38 now. Yeah, so he's been in the Shiga Prefecture pretty much all of his life, which is a certain area of Japan. And he's moved around a few different places based on his dad's work, because his dad is a truck worker. Mm-hmm. But he's now based quite close to this particular studio. And ever since he was one, he had to go for some tests, as all Japanese people do. And the tests highlighted when he was 1 year old that he had some form of a mental disability, but they didn't understand what it was. So from that point onwards, he always went to special schools, because although his family wanted him to go to just the regular high school that everyone else went to, they knew that it would have been more beneficial for him to be able to go to these special schools. So he went to one and then graduated and then went to the next one up, and he attended these schools until he was 18 years old. And I thought what was really interesting when I was talking to some people that work with him the other day is that he went one day to another special school when he was 15 years old. And that was the first time he encountered clay. And when he went to this special school, he made a little frog out of clay. Mm. And I saw a photo of it the other day, actually, so I'll have to share it with you. And that must be the basis then of, Lynn, you know, his clay work when he went to the studio stemmed from this one encounter that he had making this little clay frog.
Where's the frog now? Is that with his family? Because he lives with his family, doesn't he?
He lives with his family. I don't know if that particular frog still exists, but I know he has made a few other frogs when he first started going to the institution. But the clay frog was based on a paper frog that he made at home. So ever since he was 4 years old, he used to like to make things at home and be quite creative, even though his family weren't very creative. So they've said to me that he used to like the cigarette packs of his dad's tobacco. So he used to take those empty tobacco packets and kind of utilize them for origami or little things he made with his hands. And then when he was 6 years old and started eating more sweets, he was using the wrappers from the sweets to reconstruct the cigarette packets, but out of sweet wrappers. So he's always used to doing things with his hands across his whole life.
So cool.
And making little different bits and pieces. So this paper model frog that he built was when he was 12, and he used to like looking at animal picture books. Yeah. And then looked at one, got some paper and made a little frog out of paper just based on what he saw in front of him and how he thought it should go together.
Isn't
to just
fancy?
Find really interesting. And I only found that out the other day.
I can't wait to see this frog. But he's been described as having ladylike fingers, which I don't know
yes.
if that's politically correct to say.
It's but possibly not politically
possibly
correct,
not, but
he has got very long, slender.
Very long, elegant, very
elegant. Very elegant,
long,
yes.
And they bend, they seem to, when I've watched videos of him, they seem to bend beyond the normal, what other people's fingers bend
they
at.
Said, they said that. They said dexterous.
Dexterous
say
or dexterity.
Dexterous, yeah.
You know, there's certain people who play pianos and they say when you have hands like that, you're an amazing, you can be an amazing pianist because you can stretch like the whole beyond the octave, and you can you can have the, if you've got hands like that, you can be an amazing classical pianist.
Oh,
just
wow.
Fact,
didn't know that.
Wada could do that. But we're seeing him. That's what we're seeing him when he creates, and what Rob introduced this episode as saying he felt meticulous, is that you see him meticulously crafting these very, very intricate, visionary kind of creatures that are made up from his imagination that he brings out in the world. But they're very detailed, and there's so many elements that go into them. Mm-hmm. How did you come to find his practice? How did it come into your orbit?
I first came across his work in 2007, I think it was, and I went to the collection, the Art Brew collection in Lausanne, and they were planning to have an exhibition called Japan, which was outsider artists from Japan.
And this is an outsider institution space. Sorry, this is just
this is where Dubuffet, Jean Dubuffet's collection is housed in Lausanne. It's a beautiful collection. It's a beautiful old building that's just being closed for quite a while because they're now making it more accessible, which is a win-win situation.
Yes, yes.
But it has an incredible collection in there. And so they acquired 13 of his works in 2007. And then in 2008 did this Japan show. And I got to go behind the scenes just before they opened that show. So that's when I first came across his work. And then started to talk more to his studio from about 2012 onwards.
What was your first feeling when you saw it?
Amazing. I mean, it's like something you've never seen before. They're so different and so unusual, and they're so not of the norm. And I think that's what I loved about them. You're like, what the hell are these? How are they made? Like, you know, what's all this? What are these little spikes? Like, they're fascinating to look
yes.
at. And when you had them alongside all the other works in the show, they just really stood out because they were just, they're quite empowering when you look at them, like even just one, let alone a whole body of them together.
Yeah, they do have a kind of charge, don't they? Like a kind
yeah.
of, like an inner spirit or something that seems to emanate like power from it, but in a very like loving, peaceful kind of way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They also make me think of like ancient history. Like they almost feel like they could have just been like unearthed and they're kind of like treasures of like another civilization or totally, which I adore as well.
Very fierce but delicate is the way I
describe them. Because there's a strength to them, but they don't seem like violent or scary. They're more like welcoming and but just know who they are. There's this real sense of self in them. But also I heard that when he was 18 and he went to join this institution where he would start to be creative half the day and then half the day work, the actual like teachers didn't actually have a space yet for ceramics, is that right? So they kind of built this shed.
So there's so there's this little cabin which is called a camaba, which means a ceramic place, basically. So there's this little like shack almost made out of sheet metal that's quite close to the studio, but up into the mountains a bit in a vast foresty kind of area. Mm. And you have to go there by car and, you know, it's all off the beaten track. And there's no real door, there's no windows, there's just big open gaps at the side of these sheet metal things. So it gets very cold. So he can't go there when it's winter time because it's just not good to work in those conditions, especially with clay.
Mm. Yeah.
So he stops going there on the 20th of December and then doesn't go back until the end of February when it's slightly warmer. And it is literally a shack, and he is taken there, and sometimes there's one or maybe two other artists there with him. But as he's mostly nonverbal, he doesn't really communicate with the others, and he just goes there, sets himself up, gets his clay out, and then kind of gets on with himself for 3 or 4 hours and then leaves again. And what I find really wonderful is that when he goes into the studio and like he gets out the piece that he's working on, he then gets out his little pot of clay, and then he gets kind of older pieces that have been drying out and puts them on the side next to him, sometimes one, sometimes 3 or 4. And I almost feel like he's creating a little crowd or like a little row of friends next to him. Like an audience, or, you know, here's me and here's my friends, kind of, you know, who knows what his mind is thinking. But I like to think he's got his friends there watching him kind of create these sculptures. And I love that thought that he carefully places them one by one and then works on his piece and then puts them all back almost to sleep or to bed at night, kind of when he leaves.
Do you think he forms a really close attachment to his works in the fact that, you know, now that they're being sold, that he misses them? Or do you think that they're part of just the process of creativity that he's channeling?
I think it's definitely more about the process for him, because the man, Mr. Ikatani, that works with him said that once he's finished with one and it's gone on the shelf, he's very much onto the next one and very much doesn't look back, or, you know, doesn't seem to hold any emotion towards the ones that he's created. He's straight onto the next one. So I think the process for him, and the, like you said, the meticulous process, the precision and everything about it is what's important to him.
Yeah. Before they discovered him creating clay, they didn't really have this location or this setup for him. But since he started to really blossom, they kind of created this
And there's like 2 hand-built kilns there as well. So he uses Shigaraki clay, which is the area that they're based in. And it's kind of almost similar to Shigaraki techniques that they kind of utilize with his work. So it's almost like they call Shigaraki ware means like cave kilns, because it's these little kilns that you can kind of fully walk inside and kind of place things inside. And then they're called that because there's a certain way that you have to utilize the kilns. So for his work, they only fire this kiln up twice a year because there's so much wood that has to go into it that they then have to chop, source, find and store all within this little hut as well. And then Mr. Ikatani stays awake for 3 days and 3 nights, which seems bizarre to me, feeding wood into the hut, into the kiln, sorry.
On his own there with this?
I've seen photos. There's definitely other people keeping him company, but he likes to be the one doing it because he's done it for so many years now. You know, this is going back 20 years.
Wow.
And he feeds the wood in and keeps it at 1,200 degrees Celsius for 3 days and 3 nights. And then it's left for a week to cool down. And there's this magical, there's some photos with this like magical glow coming out the back of the kiln.
So why only twice a year? Because there's so much.
It's so expensive. The amount of firewood needed to keep it at that temperature for 3 days and 3 nights is so expensive for this particular studio that they can only afford to do it twice a year. So even though Sawada's quite a prolific artist and then the work dries out for 6 months, he can only fire so many every year, so, and some of those might get damaged in the kiln.
Yeah.
So there's never a massive amount that gets produced by the end of that year.
Right. It's really interesting, that idea of like tradition and kind of care that leader of the centre takes, mm-hmm. you know, even in firing up these kilns. Mm-hmm. It's such a wonderful, it seems like quite a caring, you know, everyone's putting in a lot of effort, aren't they, mm-hmm. to make this possible?
Yeah.
And I love the idea of making the shed as well. It's so genius. But what do you think he does on the months off, you know, from the time in the winter when he's not able to does he still create other things?
Like, so he does. So he still goes into the institution, the main building, and still does his bakery stuff the mornings he would normally do. And then when he first went to the studio, he did actually do stitched work, which is called sashiko, which is almost like very neat, tidy lines, horizontal and vertical lines. But the studio said there's only three of those works now remaining that he made, because he gave that up and started on the ceramics. But if he's not at the studio, until 2014, he was at home making these little paper vehicles, which some will be on show in New York. And again, it's the first time they're going to be on show in New York. And he very carefully tears tiny little bits of paper and makes these small 3D models of buses, trucks and cars, and makes all the insides. So there's little seats in them. There's wing mirrors on tiny bits of wire that you can move out and push sideways. There's the steering wheel. The doors actually open and close. And on one of them that I saw the other day, there's a sliding door of this food truck. Right. On the back of it, and I was like, oh my god, it actually slides.
So when did he start making these? Sorry,
what? So he started making those in 2001 and stopped only in 2014, and only made them at home. And the only reason he stopped, which I love, is that his family bought a computer and now he plays Mario instead.
Oh, really? Oh, that's kind of sad. I mean, he's playing Super Mario, but I mean, that's kind of sad that creativity has been channeled into.
I know. I just it makes me laugh, because I think, well, you had all this creativity you were doing at home, and then suddenly a computer came, and then technology's taken over, and that side of things.
Which is quite surprising. He's still doing the clay then, if the kind of computer took him away from his paper sculptures, that he still goes back to the clay. That feels like it's compulsive.
I think he's so passionate about it, and the studio have said, like, you know, although he has to do the bakery stuff, he's really not very passionate, and he has no sort of want to kind of develop that side of it. He knows how to make particular things and will make those. And then as soon as he can get out to the hut, he goes with Mr. Ikitani out to the hut and then works for 4 hours straight. And they said that during that time, you know, he barely eats, he barely drinks. He's purely focused on the clay work in front of him. And if he ever wants anything or needs any support or anything, because he's nonverbal, they've kind of developed this kind of just, he has little symbols that he might do. So he might wave or he might do another sort of gesture. And then Mr. Ikitani, because he's worked with him for so long, will know what that gesture means and will then get him whatever he needs to move forward.
Oh my God, I love Mr. Ikitani. I want Mr. Ikitani in my life.
And what's lovely about him, I mean, he's so old now, and he was actually retired before Sawada started doing ceramics, and so he's now continued all these years, even though he's this little old man and is meant to be retired, and just goes and supports him. And he said that he's never taught him anything. He literally puts the clay down in front of him and leaves him to it, and said if he's ever tried to show him anything, he basically gets shut down by Sawada and basically pushed away. And
oh my God, they should make a documentary about the teacher. I love it.
I think he features in a couple I've seen. So let's talk about these actual creations of Sawada's. So I like the fact that he makes bread in the morning, because to me there's something very bready about the quality, the texture of the sculptures. They feel very kind of doughy, and they've got their element to them. But they're
kneaded as well. Yeah. Like the kind of, intensity of action.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's created through clay this kind of personal mythology. So you can look at them all when they'd be like the wings of a bird, the face of a dragon, a lizard, the profile of an owl. They're all kind of like creatures and demons of his imagination. Mm-hmm. That he then creates these kind of beings into the world that are imaginary, but he brings them to life in ceramic art. But there's something so satisfying about them. But let's talk about what they kind of look like and how they vary.
Yeah, I mean, and also the colour of them is quite bready because they have this kind of oatmeal-y colour.
Yes.
And they've never got any glaze put on them when they go into the kiln. Because it's such a high temperature, the kind of the lustre that you get across the surface and like the reddish tones and the greyish tones is all kind of the crystallization of the ash in the kiln. And that's what gives it its colour. So depending on where it is in the kiln depends whether it goes slightly greyer or slightly redder, all based on the the ash that's kind of travelling around from the firewood. But what I thought was really interesting, I saw a photo the other day of this particular piece, and I've never seen one like it before, and I was like, what the hell is that? And I'm sure you'll be able to share it. And when I was asking them about it, in Japan there's this an animal symbol that's like a good luck charm, which is called Shigaraki Tanuki, which is like a raccoon dog type thing, and people put it in their houses and it's in shop windows, and it has 8 different reasons why it's meant to be like a symbol of good luck. And they said that he obviously sees it when he walks to and from the center in different places, and so it's his interpretation from seeing this weird creature thing. When you see a picture of it on the internet, you'll think it's quite strange, but his interpretation is it's so incredible. And when I found out what it was, I was like, oh my god, that makes complete sense. I mean, it's a really weird, strange animal creature thing.
Yes.
With this like bowl under his arm, and I was like, wow, I've never seen anything like that he's done. And when they explained that to me, and I was like, that is his interpretation and his memory of seeing this thing when he's walked to and from the center, which I loved. But otherwise, we never really know what they are because he never really talks about it, obviously. But they are like dragons, lizards. They also said he makes oni, which is like almost like a demonic creature face, like a bit like a devil, with horns. So some of his war-based work has horns and like devilish long teeth. And this is like a folklore thing from Japan that he must have obviously seen growing up in books and things.
Yeah.
And that's kind of starting to come through in some of his works as well. But I think that's what I love about them, that they look a bit like something, but they could be something else. It has an element of a lizard, but then it has this weird tail, or it looks a bit like this, but then it has a long snout.
But then he has these spikes. So the older works, and I know that they've changed, and we could talk about touch on that, but they're really recognisable for these little spikes, intricate spikes that cover the bodies of these creatures. And I think you just spoke to us earlier on, like there's some recent kind of unearthing of where he's got his inspiration from, and like you've said, this good luck charm. But then you found something recently about why you think these spikes have entered into his practice as well.
So when he first started going to the centre, they said it was around about 2002, he went on a field trip to this temple, which is called Temple Tadaiji. It's about 40 minutes away from where he is, and within this temple is one of the largest bronze Buddhas statues within the world. And so he went there on this field trip. There was about 3 of them that all went there. And if you look at a photo of it, on the hair of the Buddha, it's like these small, rounded spikes all over the head of this Buddha. And so Mr. Ikitani thinks that after he came back from there, from this field trip, that's when these spikes started to appear on his work. But they're obviously more pointy than the ones on the Buddha. But they think, and obviously we'll never know, but it started after that field trip, and that's potentially where his kind of thinking was. And that's why these kind of spikes then started to appear all over his works, just like it covers the entire head of this Buddha.
A friend of mine was talking to me last night about, I sent the works over to him, and he mentioned to me immediately he was taken by them because he's really into folklore. And it got me thinking about folklore, because folklore is often a way of kind of telling, you know, stories of a community or of a nation, and kind of like, you know, tales and fables and kind of, you know, narratives. And what I find so interesting about this kind of work is that he's telling us narratives very directly through the actual object and through the visuals. And this idea of visual kind of artwork and sculpture being a universal language in itself. So even though he's a non-verbal person, it's like he's able to communicate and experience, you know, feelings and emotions through the actual art itself. Do you know what I mean? Like as a visual communication language.
Definitely.
And do you think that's partly why he's gone on to be so popular, like, across the world?
Mm-hmm. I mean, potentially, yeah. I mean, he doesn't speak, so his artwork is what's speaking for him, and they're so fascinating to look at. And sort of, you know, being profiled through the Venice Biennale in 2013 in Gioni's Encyclopedic Palace, that's what really pushed him into several people's sphere within the contemporary art world, because people, you know, they've never come across anything like this. It was, you know, profiled in this really beautiful way behind these cabinets in kind of a semicircle within the palace. And I wrote down what Gioni said. He said that he liked them because they were like Borges' Book of Imaginary Beings, and they were like medieval creatures or pre-Columbian sculptures.
Yeah,
and that's why he was drawn to them. And I think, yeah, that they're so different to what people will, you know, come across within contemporary art galleries, but, you know, within anywhere really. And I think this is what draws people in. You know, they've come across something, they've not seen it before. And because you can't really find out very much about the artist or why they make them or where their inspiration is from, is what makes people even more interested in them, because they are this mythical kind of strange imaginary being that you just want to know more, and you'll never find it all out because he's non-verbal.
About the human condition, isn't it? It's about really trying to understand the human condition. I think that's why so many self-taught outsider, outlier, art brute artists are so fascinating, is because they are making art outside of an art market, outside of art history, outside of the mainstream conversation. They're just being compelled to make art. And when they create these visions, they challenge us, because for us it's like, how have you realized this without really referencing anything else? There's a fascination.
I also feel like that this work in particular really speaks to all of our subconscious. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a part of ourselves we often don't want to acknowledge or even confront, you know, almost like dreaming, but like it's a part of you you're not totally consciously aware of. And I really, every time I look at his work, it brings back kind of things that I feel that I'm not aware I feel. Does that make sense? Like it's super kind of underneath. And that's what I love about it. I feel like it brings up feelings I wasn't aware I even had. It's really fascinating.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
Do you know what's really exciting about this, Jen, is that I know a massive drive for you has always been working with artists who are developing, who are self-taught, disabled, but you want to bring them into the mainstream conversation with contemporary art. Mm-hmm. And what's exciting is that, talking about the Venice show in 2013 and now going forward, it feels like this is really happening mm-hmm. for you, and that's a huge... achievement and mm-hmm. you know, celebration for you mm-hmm. and that's something you want to continue doing, right?
Oh yeah, massively. I mean, there'll always be people that will just want the two fields kept very separate, outside art and contemporary art, and they'll always, you know, this is this and there should never be any crossover. Whereas, you know, the gallery Venus over Manhattan did a Joseph Joachim show 2019, and he's classed as a self-taught visionary artist, and you know, within a contemporary gallery space, and that got so much publicity and press, and again changed the way that this artist was seen. And now he's going on to have a solo show at MoMA, which is just incredible for an artist like that. It's just amazing. So to have these artists like Sawada now having this show within this contemporary space, and also he's just had a show in two museums in Germany, which are contemporary sculpture museums, it completely just changes the way that people see this art. And it's not just seen as a disabled person's art anymore. Mm. It's looked at in a different way. And I think critics look at it in a different way. And for me, that's really important, because I really dislike the way that people might stereotype the work of people with disabilities and disabled people and just be like, you know, in my head, it only looks this way and I can't ever, you know, look at it in another way. And then by a contemporary gallery or museum profiling it, it starts to shift people's attitudes and shift the way they're thinking. And for me, that's really important, because, you know, self-taught artists create the most incredible work that is so underseen. You know, it's barely seen within these kind of contemporary art circles, and it really needs to have more profile and more people talking about it and more light shone on it, rather than us seeing the same thing, the same names coming out over and over again at these big institutions. Like, why can't they switch it up and throw something else into the mix and be like, let's try this for a change? And if it bombs, it bombs. You know, the fact is that they've taken a chance on, you know, something other than the norm, and then they're trying to test the waters to see what it's like for their audiences, and I bet their audience will love it.
Yeah. How did Venus over Manhattan discover his work, and how did you guys connect?
I met Adam.
This is Adam Lindemann, isn't it?
Adam Lindemann, who runs it. I mean, he set it up in 2012. I probably met him 3 years ago in New York, very briefly at the Outsider Art Fair, and then he got in touch with me last year. And I talked to him quite a bit at the fair, and then he got back in touch to say, you know, I've been thinking about this artist for a long time now, and I obviously saw it in Venice. And he, for him and his gallery, he said that what he's really passionate is showing artists that he thinks have been somewhat overlooked and deserve more recognition. And I really like that idea that, you know, for me, Sawada, although he was profiled then, you know, since then he's been in several museum shows, but they're often outsider-based shows. So it's not been back into the contemporary arts market in that respect for a while. So to have it back profiled, like it was in Frieze in 2019, the attention that it got then, when I was over there talking to people, people were fascinated by the works, you know, this contemporary art audience seeing this thing. And when I walked around Frieze, I was like, there's nothing like this here, actually. Yeah. Like, this work really stands out for me because, you know, although, I mean, I'm biased because I love it. But when I walked around and I was like, there is nothing like Sawada's work, you know, it stands on its own. It's unique. And, you know, everyone should have one in their house.
Well, a lot of people do. There are so many collectors, myself included. I'm a super fan of Sawada. But we have other really high-profile collectors, especially Kors, who has a great collection. It's where I first saw the work. When me and Rob went to visit Kors for our Talkite episode, he had two Sawadas that were on his table, his kind of iconic table that sits in front of his couch that all of his guests sit on when he posts. And we sat there, and they were there. And that's how we got in contact, because we tagged you, and then that's how, well, you said they're actually Sawada anyway. But Kors is a big collector and a big champion. He's a massive champion of outsider artists. But he's really gaining this massive collector base, and, you know, this show is going to open him up to so many people,
which is really important. And there was an article that Holland Cotter from the New York Times wrote in 2019, actually, about New MoMA opening, and obviously opening on the old site of the American Folk Art Museum. And he was, you know, he wrote this article saying, you know, when you reopen, let's not have any more Rauschenbergs, let's not have any more Richters. You're going to let more self-taught artists in. And then he did a list of, like, which artists should be in MoMA, and Sawada was one of them. And I was like, yes, he should be there. And he's still not, but yes, he should be.
Well, maybe after this show, there should be an acquisition after this. I mean, how many works are going to be in this show?
There's about 30 works in the show.
Ceramics,
ranging from his earlier works right up. There's one work from 2020 that just got fired before it went out there. So it gives a nice cross section of the style with the spikes and then the slightly more varied style as time's gone on. So MoMA needs to be acquiring one.
I think they all do. We were saying earlier on about the spikes, and you were saying that they've kind of lessened now. There's a story about why that transition is practice has kind of changed recently.
Yeah, so in 2017, another artist, a different artist to the ones he normally works with, called Akio Kontani, started coming to the studio and started to come to the ceramics hut where he works. And Contini's work has a real focus around the face and the mouth and kind of building out from there. But they're very much simplified forms, not covered in spikes or anything, sometimes more animally with octopus tentacles and that sort of thing. And then ever since he started going to the studio, there's been a real shift in Sawada's work, and kind of the spikes have started to disappear now. And they're more focused on the faces and more focused on the mouths with bigger teeth, much like Contini's are. They're still very recognisable as Sawada's work, but they haven't got these spikes over them anymore. And sometimes I had one a couple of years ago that had like octopus tentacles at the side, and then I had it like next to Contini's octopus that he'd made, and I was like, wow, you can really see how one's influenced the other one in kind of the marks that they make. And some Contini's were quite simple and not much texture on them, and then as he's been staying at the studio, his have now got a bit more texture on them, marks made.
They're borrowing from each other.
Even though they don't communicate verbally, their art is like having a communication with each other, and kind of it's almost like they're bouncing ideas without having to verbally bounce them. They're artistically bouncing ideas.
And something that's quite unique to Sawada's faces is that he often has more than one face on on a work, or he could have like faces upon faces.
Yeah, like
and
totems.
They kind of like grow, you know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is so genius. Where do you think this is the face? Like, is it representing like himself, maybe? Is it like what is this obsession?
I guess that's a thing that we never know, and we'll never know either why he does it. But they did say that he likes to have, he likes, I think he used to see pictures of like the Taj Mahal and stuff, and they said he obviously seemed to be interested in the symmetry in buildings and things like that, which is why he likes to have symmetry in his work. Again, this is all speculation, but yeah, in their eyes, they say, you know, they like, he likes to have one thing and then the face and everything is the same on the opposite side. So quite often they're two-sided and they're almost symmetrical on the both sides of the piece. So although the spikes might be going slightly different ways and the eyes might be slightly bigger or something, they're very symmetrical. And sometimes there's four-sided ones, with like a face on every side, or sometimes there's a face on either side and then big spikes all the way up the side, but they always have like a symmetrical look to them. And they think it's because of things he's looked at over the years and seem to have liked the symmetry. And I think that featured in his textile work as well, having kind of symmetrical patterns.
I also really discovered something recently about his work, and that's what's so cool about it, is I feel like every few months, the more you look at his work, you find different themes. And Russell actually has one, which is a kind of crawling creature, a bit more like an animal or something. Like it's not so totemic. It's more like it's literally walking across the floor. And that kind of animation and motion really surprised me. I was like, I thought they were more still and contained than that. Mm-hmm. And Russ was really into it. And initially I was really taken aback, and now I'm getting really into it. Can you speak a bit about like those walking ones? Because they're amazing, aren't they?
There are a few. I haven't had that many, actually. I've had a few lizardy ones, but the one that Russell's got has got these like weird longish kind of legs, almost a bit spider-like, maybe. Yes. They kind of curve up and arch down.
With talons on the end.
Yes. And they're fascinating. It's like claw, like you said earlier, it's a mix of different things. It's like the claws of a hawk with these weird spider legs with this kind of weird round body, but then it's got this reptile like thing down the middle with these long spikes, a bit like a dragon. It's like so many different things formed into one. That's what I love about his work. Every time I unpack one, when I open them, I get really excited because I'm like, what's it going to be this time? What's it going to have on it? What's this? And like his newest work, the 2020 piece, is literally the one side is like two small eyes at the top and then this massive wide open mouth that covers the entire rest of the front of it with big teeth at the front, at the top and the bottom. And then all around the back is this like wavy hair. And it's so different to any of the others.
Wow,
and I was just like,
I'd love to see that. Is that going to the show?
That's gone in the show in New York. And I was like, this almost looks a bit like a person with this wavy hair at the back, but then this terrifying open mouth with these like big fangs at the top and the
it's
bottom.
Like Rob.
And I was like,
it's me with my lockdown wavy locks.
Is he aware of his success?
No.
Not at all. What do you think? I mean, we can never know what he's thinking, but
no.
The process of making these works, firing them, and then he never sees them again because the studio and you have like this organized, gallerist situation.
Yeah.
What does he think's happening to them, do you think?
I mean, his studio said that, you know, he doesn't really ever show much emotion. And I think this is partly because of his autistic diagnosis. And so for him, it is just the process. Like he really enjoys making them, and then it seems like if he never sees them again, that's probably fine. But within the institution, within the main building, because they're so proud of him, and obviously he's the artist that's got the most attention from the studio, as soon as you walk through the doors, there's an entire wall of his artwork, like his tiny original, he made these like really tiny little lizards to begin with that have got like, you know, just three spikes along the back and a little face.
Love.
And like his little frogs and that sort of thing, right up to like really big ones. And they have this cabinet with loads of different size holes in it. And in each hole is like a different Sawada.
Have you got a picture of that?
I've got a photo of that. I saw that when I went there. So like he every time he goes there, he will see his artwork because it is all there for everyone to see as soon as you walk through the doors. And then, so yeah, it's not like he's never surrounded by it. And obviously he's every day when he's in the ceramics hut, it's all there drying out around him. And there's just shelves and shelves for 6 months. It has to dry out on these shelves. So he's constantly surrounded by his works. Yeah. It's not like he never sees any of it. And like I said, he puts it next to him every day. So it's like his little chums with him in the studio.
And what about his family? Are they super proud of his success? Because they must be aware of it all.
Yeah. So I think originally, I mean, they obviously thought he was very creative because he used to make all these little things out of paper and stuff at home. And so they obviously noticed he had this kind of creative streak. And that's why when he graduated high school, they were really keen for him to go to an institution that did artwork there. And I think to begin with, until he started to get recognised, which wasn't until maybe 2006, 2007, I guess they just saw, you know, they were proud of what he did, but, you know, just saw him going there and maybe he'd have some work in a show locally in Japan or something. And then when his work started to get out more, you know, around the world, and when things started to take shape and when they started to hear about things, they are very, very proud of what he's achieved. His mommy's dad and his sister as well are so super proud of him, and so are the institution staff. And I don't think they fully understand, even they don't fully understand his success, and, you know, the fact that he was in Freeze in New York, the fact he had this massive thing in the Venice Biennale, because they won't have traveled there to see it either. Then for them, you know, they might read about it, and if their English isn't that good, there's never really anything in Japanese written about, you know, these particular shows. So they go off photos and that sort of thing. So they often get sent photos. I always send them photos and things from things that I do. So they're so very proud of him. But I don't think they fully understand how much people love his artwork when they see it. And, you know, I don't think they fully, I've quite got the head around the fact that he's having this solo show in New York. Either they're just like,
but with his success comes a commercial art market success. Mm-hmm. So you're selling his works. Mm-hmm. How does that? Where does that money go? Because I wouldn't assume that he would be aware of what money was or care about money. Mm-hmm. Does that go back to the studios and his family? And what is that sort of? Because they're becoming quite expensive now, and that's quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
What sort of lifestyle do they have there? Is that kind of changing their life there and helping him further?
I mean, their lifestyle doesn't really change. I mean, the money is going back to his studio, and then he gets a portion of that. So because the studio pay for all the materials and all that sort of thing, there's an element of that where they recoup some of their costs, and also the high costs of putting the kiln on to fire his artwork. But then he does get a high percentage of that. Well, the money goes to his family. Because for Sawada, you know, he doesn't understand the concept of money or anything like that. So the money goes to his family. So I'm pretty sure, you know, he'll get treats, he'll get different things, you know. If he wanted something, maybe he wants a new computer game. I'm pretty sure he'll get a new computer game.
A lot of Super Marios,
So the money is split between I get some, and then the studio and the artist gets some, which is pretty much the same with any kind of situation.
Absolutely.
And I've seen a few pictures of him at work, and obviously he works completely in silence and very kind of slowly and meticulously, but he looks really content. And I thought that's such a great thing, is to his family to have found that place for him to study and to work as well. He looks like he's really sort of happy and enjoying himself. And surely that is like the key thing any family would want for their child, is for them to be sort of fulfilling their potential and reaching that potential. And I really feel like he's, you know, way surpassed that. And it's just nice to see that he looks really sort of happy somehow.
And I think he loves it. And the fact that he goes there for 4 hours nonstop and, you know, almost doesn't want to take a break to have a drink or eat something. Like he'll just fully continue until they say to him, you know, it's time to go home now. And then he puts everything away. I mean, the dedication there and the fact that he's done it for so many years. There was a short time where he didn't go for 9 months because he wasn't very well. And this was a few years ago now. And then as soon as he was better, he was straight back in that studio. Mm. You know, as soon as he was allowed to go back, he was there, back in the studio, back working again. It's almost like he was desperate to get back to do it.
Oh, bless.
That's an authentic creative self, isn't it? That's,
totally. And he's obviously so dedicated to it and, you know, creates one every 4 to 5 days and then moves on to the next one.
I think it must be so satisfying because it looks so kind of meditative and like, I don't know, calm. And, and
he's in the zone.
And you get lost in that world. It must be really enjoyable. That's
in one of these videos, I saw an incredible sight of him photographing or capturing the finished works with, they called it his memory camera. So he sits there and he holds up as if he's holding like a camera in his hand, and he goes around really slowly, and it's, there's nothing in his hand, but he's like he's like miming that there is, and takes this photograph for his memory of the finished piece. But have you seen him do that? And what is that
like? I didn't see him do that when I was there, but I actually know quite a few artists, learn disabled artists, that do that. Actually, and they have like, it's like a fake camera, so it's like they're capturing it for their memory with their camera. And I've seen that happen quite often actually in different studios that I visited, so I wouldn't say that's unique to Sawada, but it's something that obviously puts it into the memory and kind of stores it somewhere.
And that's not taught. That's their own process.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a kind of slightly universal thing.
I've definitely seen other people do that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like that thought.
I feel like I need to be doing that more often as well. Like we one need, for the memory bank.
Put the actual iPhone down and actually just like do a memory camera.
Yeah.
It makes me feel a bit emotional because it's also that kind of pride maybe of like that moment or it's something special, isn't it, that you want to remember. I mean, what a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Love that.
I mean,
what
a detailed
mind he's got. Yeah.
I know. I do think he has a lot of pride in his work. I mean, you can see, I mean, when you see the ones with the spikes, the way that they're so meticulously placed, like so exact in a straight line, like he's not like haphazardly throwing them on. He obviously takes a lot of pride that everything is on exactly how he wants it to be put on. And I guess that's one of his autistic traits, that everything has to be almost like perfect when he does it. But, you know, there's obviously a lot of pride and a lot of care and a lot of attention to detail gone into that artwork.
So how is the show going to work then? Because it opens very soon. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're not able to travel anywhere, being in the United Kingdom.
I'm so sad. I really want to. So
I'm really
are
sad.
You doing it all over, are you doing it over Zoom? Or how is that all going to... Because you've got 30 ceramics and you have the paperworks in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a title for the show as well? Has he got a title?
It's just called Shinichi Sawada.
Right, okay.
Shinchi. They like to call him. Which is probably how you do pronounce it, but I always say Shinichi because...
I think I said Shinichi. Shinichi.
So how will you install it?
Well, that's obviously all got to be left up to Venus over Manhattan.
Oh, okay, right.
So they've got all the works now. The paper cars arrive this week because they came a little bit later. And then they're installing it on two big tables within the middle of the rooms for people to be able to walk around and see them from all the different sides of them, which is really important for me in particular, that you can see them from all the different angles. And there will be a video walkthrough, obviously, because lots of people won't be able to get there. So that's one of the things that we talked about with them. And at the moment, they're always doing video walkthroughs, like a live one, and then one that's like a computerized one as well. And then I'm really passionate about things being accessible. So I'm having the... exhibition text is done in American Sign Language and in British Sign Language to go onto their website so that deaf audiences can start to learn a bit more about this artist, which is really important for me.
Fantastic.
As well.
Is this the same works that were in his two German shows?
No. That's still in Berlin, in closed down, collecting dust right now, which is really sad.
He's an institution. So institution, we're talking about MoMA, which is the wish list, but there are other institutions that are acquiring his work, right?
There are some institutions, but they're mainly outsider-related things. So like I said, Lausanne's got them, the House St. Pierre in Paris has got them. There's lots of independent collectors. There's the ABCD collection in Paris. The Demand collection has got them. So there's lots of independent collections, museums, and then individual collectors and lots of contemporary artists by him as well. But he needs to be in more contemporary art museum collections.
Public institutions.
Definitely. Yeah, public institutions like the Tate and MoMA.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what you're going to do, Jen. That's what we're all going
to
do.
That is, yes, we all need to.
Hopefully, some of them are listening now. Those curators, and the people. Maybe there's even people listening who could actually like help financially support a donation or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that could also work.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen with work in MoMA that's been bought by someone very passionate about it, and then they've donated it. Like Judith Scott's work was donated to MoMA, which was amazing.
What's Judith Scott's work like?
Judith Scott makes wrapped sculptures. So she went to Creative Growth, an art studio in America, and finds things around the studio. I talked about her in the last talk. Finds things around the studio and wraps them in different materials, and had this really wonderful process of wrapping and tying and creating these massive things with maybe like a part of a chair inside it and part of a fan. And there's one of her works that's currently on display in MoMA, in a room full of just contemporary artworks, which is
brilliant.
Incredible.
Brilliant. And another artist from Creative Growth, William Scott, mm-hmm. he's about to have a solo at Studio Voltaire in London. Matthew from White Columns, who we love, mm-hmm. he has organised that alongside Studio Voltaire, and that's incredibly exciting. Do you know a bit about William Scott's work?
Well, I'm going to the talk that's on next week that they're
Same.
Doing, which is
yeah,
amazing.
Signed up for that.
But yeah, Matthew Higgs has been quite instrumental in kind of pushing William's work out there as well. And I'm sure he's had a solo show at White Columns in New York. Mm-hmm. But he creates these really, I love looking at his work because it's joyful. It makes me smile of these characters, many black figures, many black characters, many famous people feature in his work. I'm pretty sure he did Diana Ross. So he has these incredible drawings and things. And then what I also love about him is they do this annual fundraiser every year, this catwalk show. And he quite often walks down the catwalk in this mask of the guy from Star Wars. Can't think what
Darth Vader.
Yes.
No.
which I also particularly enjoy.
I love that. Yeah.
So that's really exciting. Actually, the Studio Voltaire kind
of. Yeah, but that's an institutional space that are mm-hmm, bringing mm-hmm. artists in mm-hmm. that are, you know, seen as normally marginalised and bringing them into the mm-hmm. mainstream and bringing them as being part of the conversation. So that's
Studio Voltaire did a show of Naina Kalu from Action Space, which is a London-based studio, last year, and they hired a space in Mayfair and basically gave her free rein to build this incredible sculpture within this space under Studio Voltaire's banner. And Naina, again, is like a non-verbal artist attending a studio in London that wraps things. So she built this massive installation and wrapped loads of pieces and had bits of tape dripping off them and paper dripping off them. And Studio Voltaire just fully back to having this, just do what you want in this space kind of thing.
I love that.
They also did a show with John Sheehy,
mm-hmm,
who's
an
outsider
yeah.
painter
yeah.
artist, and they did an amazing installation of his.
Yeah,
which
and he's London based as well.
Yeah, he's London. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Islington
wow.
somewhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been on before, and we've asked you these questions before, which are the question we ask everyone, which is your art heist and your favourite colour. But do you think that has changed since we last did the interview at all? Your art heist. Have you come across any incredible works recently?
Or is there a Shinchi work that you might...
Yes, what's
your favourite Shinchi work?
Yes,
I sold the one that I wanted, which is devastating.
What does it look like? What did it look like? Does it look like?
It was... I've only ever had one of them, and it's one of the ones that people are very... Whenever they contact me about him, they all kind of want this one particular one. I think he's very famous for this work. It has a very wide head on the top
like
of it.
Butterfly
like
wings.
Like a rugby ball head.
Yes. Yes.
And it has these little weird, almost like dinosaur T-Rex hands coming out the front of it.
Mm.
And it's covered in spikes and it has these massive big eyes. And it went to this wonderful collection. It's gone to a lovely collection, nonetheless, in Switzerland. But
well, that's good because you know where it is, so we can.
I know where it is, so I can do an art heist.
Very effective art heist. We're there for you.
Oh, there's also two sitting in Berlin at the moment that are very similar to that. Because when he makes work, sometimes they have a very similar look to them. So there's two in Berlin, and one has a slightly wonky to one side head. So we could just go to Berlin to the closed institution and go and raid that while there's nobody there.
Do you title them or how do you differentiate? No. Do you number them or
I number them just so I know what's going on, but they're obviously untitled. But for me it's like untitled and then that's number 5 and that's number 6.
How many
just
are
purely
there now?
That I know.
How many untitled are there?
I have no idea how many they've got. And the thing is, when they're, like I said, when they're made, because they can only put the kiln on so many times, there's so many that haven't been fired
wow.
that are just sat within this little ceramics hut, which is a real shame, actually. But I'm hoping that, if we get more out there, then they'll have more money to to fire it more, and then they'll be more available and hopefully more institutions can kind of buy into them and stuff, so.
And actually, I did see that he... was part of an exhibition at the Prime Minister's office in Tokyo in Japan. So he actually attended the opening as well. There's pictures of him like doing a peace symbol, like in photographs. Like
yes, I've seen him do the peace symbol in the videos. Yeah,
next to his sculptures, and they mm-hmm. placed his sculptures outdoors on these mm-hmm. white plinths. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of that must have been a moment where he had kind of he got to see recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how he interprets that, mm-hmm. but he must have at least felt some sense of occasion, I guess.
Yeah, it is very rare for him to travel to things, but his work is shown quite often in Japan, in lots of different spaces.
He's famous in Japan, is he?
He's famous in Japan, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if we're talking like top level famous, but he's known.
He's known.
He's quite well known, I'd say. But potentially, again, still within the outsider art, his work features in lots of outsider art shows. So his work's about to feature in another exhibition in Tokyo. So yeah, he rarely travels to them, but I love that about Japanese. When I went to visit lots of the people there, whenever I had my photos with the artist, always the peace sign. I enjoy that.
Well, I can't wait for everyone to discover Shinichi Sawada's work, because I think he is a total visionary, mm-hmm. and for people to learn more about you, Jen, because you are a visionary, mm-hmm. and a nurturing legend, really. And I think more people should and will discover you. And everyone get down to or check out Venus Over Manhattan online. From February 20th to March 20th, it's Shinichi Sawada's first USA solo show called Shinichi Sawada. And thank you very much for coming on, Jen.
Yeah, and you can visit Venus's Instagram, which is V_over_M. So it's Venus, and they are on Instagram. And also you can see Jen's amazing gallery, Jennifer Lauren Gallery, also on Instagram, and we will be linking to Jen.
Oh, you didn't give us your favourite colour. We have asked you before, but people are going to be like, you didn't get the colour. What's the colour?
Well, I might change it. Last time I said black, which I feel is a bit of a cop-out, so I'm going to say navy blue.
Ooh,
it's quite close to black.
It's quite close. It is quite close to black.
Just a slight shift.
Like I said last time, though, I'm very pale, so anything dark is good for me.
And you collect black and white art.
And I only have black and white art, yes.
That's streamlining. That's very good rule for yourself. Absolutely.
Yeah, so you can visit at J_L Gallery, Jennifer Lauren Gallery, and you can learn more about the other artists that mm-hmm. Jen also champions and promotes and mm-hmm. Helps educate us all about. Mm-hmm. Super grateful for you being here. We love you. And yep.
Stick around, back. Jen, and then we'll have a little catch-up after. But,
and thank you so
also,
much.
And also, we should do this again, hopefully, at some point.
I hope we can. Yeah.
We can become a regular feature on Talk Art. But thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back very soon.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.